Hello, welcome to In Conversation With, a podcast for The Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology. I'm Gavin Cleaver, and this podcast accompanies our October 2021 issue. This issue, we mark the centenary of insulin, and there are two reviews in the issue, one on future developments in insulin, and another on the incremental advances in regenerative medicine over the last 20 years. I'm very pleased to be joined by the author of the first paper, Professor Philip Holm, who is Emeritus Professor of Diabetes Medicine at Newcastle University. And we're going to discuss the centenary of insulin and what the future looks like. Professor Holm, welcome to the podcast.
You're welcome. Good to be with you.
So we're here marking the centenary of insulin, which is pretty remarkable, honestly. What are some of the historical advances in insulin that really stand out for you? And what have been some of the major publications as well?
I think there are two or three things in that. I mean, one is obviously the initial preparation was the huge advance. But scientifically, the two advances which struck me in reviewing the history during the summer were Sanger's deciphering of the amino acid sequence of insulin, which is really quite difficult because it's two short peptides joined together with sulfide bridges, and the finding of the three-dimensional structure of insulin by Dorothy Hodgkin, which surprisingly enough actually dates back to her first work on an insulin crystal back in 1934, 1935, but it took until 1969 for the team to actually do that. So those are the two historic advantages. I have to say they influenced my career too, because as a schoolboy, I went to Manchester University and heard Sanger talk about his work on insulin in about 1965. And the interesting thing there is that when asked how has his contribution affected our understanding of how insulin works and insulin therapy, his answer was very clear: nothing at all, no way at all. And the same is true about deciphering the 3D structure of insulin by Hodgkin and co. I remember the celebration in Oxford when they cracked it in 69. It really has not yet contributed significantly to insulin. But what has really made the difference in between was recombinant DNA technology, harnessed in the late 1970s by Gilbert and Komaroff and colleagues, and Sanger again, to produce insulin in bacteria or in yeast. And initially, of course, they did that for human insulin, which was a small advantage over pork insulin, but security of supply. And then, of course, they modified the DNA structures to produce the insulin analogs. And that gave us a huge push into improving insulin therapy. So those two things, really, the scientific ones, which perhaps haven't contributed yet as much as we'd like, and the big application of recombinant DNA technology to produce insulin analogs.
You talked there briefly about moving from pork insulin to that later formulation of insulin. What was the difference to a person using insulin? What was the advantage there?
The change from pork insulin to human insulin, really at the clinical level, was not obvious. There was a lot of hype, of course, or adverts about, you know, wouldn't you treat human beings with human insulin and that kind of thing. But the difference in their pharmacokinetics of pork and human insulin was small, and already the pork insulin was being purified to an extraordinary extent, you know, just parts per million of contaminants. And of course, the human insulin had to be so purified too to make sure it didn't have yeast or E. coli contaminants. So that wasn't a change. So the introduction of human insulin by itself was not a big therapeutic advance, but it did push science. It pushed diabetes science. We started measuring insulin profiles, looking at insulin pharmacokinetics, and we harnessed the glucose clamp in reverse to look at insulin pharmacodynamics. And those contributed to the development of insulin analogs, and indeed the further developments more recently.
So your paper on developments in insulin formulations is in this month's issue of The Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology. And of course, this issue marks the centenary of insulin, which is why we're here talking about it. When we're talking about insulin, we kind of need to differentiate between endogenous and exogenous insulin. Why is it that exogenous insulin can't really approximate endogenous insulin currently?
Yes, it's important to recognize that endogenous insulin secretion in people who don't have diabetes like myself, is controlled in a very precise and rapid way. So the clearest example would be that if I was to get up from my chair now and I was to run out into the road for 50 meters, say, and run back again, then my insulin secretion by the time I got back would have halved. Obviously, with insulin injections, that's not the case. Once you've given an insulin injection, you can't do anything about insulin absorption, really, until the next insulin injection. So you can't match the insulin supply to the insulin need, and that's what you need to get a good control of glucose levels. And that's even true with pumped insulin. There's a lag time of 45 minutes between the rate of infusion and the rate of absorption. So even if you control pump insulin with, say, a sensor, you cannot get the exquisite control. Furthermore, at meal times, insulin secretion isn't controlled by glucose. The initial insulin secretion is driven by reflexes. I know I'm going to eat, I'm smelling my food, I begin to reflexly secrete insulin from my pancreas, and by incretins, once food reaches the upper part of the gut again, enhancing reflexes and by direct action on the pancreas. And you cannot, of course, imitate those things with exogenous insulin, however given. And that is a huge barrier to any kind of insulin formulation or pharmaceutical delivery of insulin.
So what are the consequences of only using exogenous insulin then in diabetic people?
So with exogenous insulin, however good it is, and even with the fastest acting mealtime analogues, we simply cannot get the kind of exquisite glucose control at mealtimes you get physiologically. Glucose levels rise from about 4 or 4.5 to a maximum of 7 physiologically, and that's simply not achievable with exogenous insulin because of the lack of the reflex and incretin effects. Furthermore, in the basal state, the sensitivity to glucose is very strong. Insulin secretion at 7 or 8 millimoles per litre is some 10 times that at 4 millimoles per litre. And that too cannot be imitated in any way with a glucose sensor. And what you see with current closed loop systems is that the algorithms and the sensing is made very sensitive electronically. And the result is you get hunting of insulin delivery. It's actually far from physiological, even in the basal state overnight with a closed loop system.
So where do insulin formulations go from here? What are kind of the next steps to, I guess, bridge this gap as much as possible?
Yes. In talking about insulin formulations, I think we have to be clear about what we mean by formulation as to a preparation. Formulations, to my mind, are what you do with insulin when you put it into the vial to deliver it. That does make a difference, and rapid-acting insulin analogs and ultra-rapid-acting insulin analogs are improvements in formulation. Essentially, they make sure that the insulin in the vial is more likely to be monomeric when delivered subcutaneously. The insulin monomer is smaller and therefore more rapidly absorbed. So that's how the rapid ones work. And there are some nice, interesting developments underway. Companies like Adocia and Arecor are developing ways of containing the insulin so they can stabilize the monomers in the vial, and that means the monomers are immediately available for absorption. So we may see yet improvements in ultra-rapid acting insulins. The other area where formulation may improve is stability for pumps. Insulin is a very unstable molecule, as I've said, particularly if you try to get it at all monomeric. And of course, insulin in pumps has to sit there for a minimum of 3 days or so after you prime the pump. And we need more stable insulins, which perhaps could sit for longer and are less prone to aggregation. And there are hints of such things being tested currently by the big companies.
Where do you hope we'll be in a few years with insulin?
In a sense, I really don't know, but the history I've seen of insulin therapy, which now extends back to kind of 1979-80, when I first worked on its pharmacokinetics, has been, it takes a long time for these technologies to work through. So I suspect we'll still largely be giving insulin by injection, particularly for people with type 2 diabetes in the foreseeable future. Perhaps in type 2 diabetes, the once weekly insulins will become useful and be introduced together, probably in combination with a GLP-1 receptor agonist. For type 1 diabetes, I'm not sure that weekly insulins are yet capable of delivering adequate smooth insulin delivery over the course of a whole week. So perhaps we should have to wait longer there. Pumped insulins and closed loop will continue to increase their market penetration, but they're up against that technological barrier of a delay in absorption of 45 minutes and a delay in sensing of 20 minutes, and therefore inability to deliver insulin at mealtimes or even stably, basally. So we then have to look at other things, regenerative medicine, where you take or create stem cells and engineer them to produce insulin and hopefully engineer them to control the insulin production as well, are certainly worth pursuing. Although, of course, they won't restore the reflex or incretin-driven pathways, perhaps. And gene therapy, people are beginning to look at ways of altering muscle cells, say, by injection of appropriate genes to produce insulin. But there again, we potentially have a regulation of supply problem.
That's really fascinating. It's been a really fascinating overview. So, Professor Philip Holm, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Good to help you today, and I hope those comments are useful to the people listening.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of In Conversation With, the podcast for The Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology. You can read our new issue online now at thelancet.com, and you can subscribe to this podcast wherever you usually get your podcasts. We hope to see you again next time.